From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The story of the origins of the United States is told using gauzy language in our history books as a myth of persecuted people settling on a largely empty nation with friendly native tribes helping out. Such a story, of course, couldn't be farther from the truth. As Native Americans struggle to be seen and heard even today, we'll focus on a fascinating story on our show about Lumbee Indians, the largest tribe in America east of the Mississippi, and its struggle for federal recognition. My guest is Melinda Maynor Lowry. She is a Lumbee Indian herself. She's an associate professor of history and director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her earlier book was called Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South, and she now joins me to discuss this new book she's just written, Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. Welcome to the program, Melinda.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us. So for those of us here in California, this is not a tribe that I confess I've heard very much of. The name is just not as familiar as some of the other higher profile tribes. And yet, as you write in your book, this is the largest Indian tribe east of the Mississippi, centered around where you are, I understand, in the North Carolina region, but really in many parts of the eastern United States. How critical is the story of this tribe to the origins of the country? And when I say the origins of the country, I should say, clarify by saying, to the arrival of settlers in the United States.
Sure. I think your phrasing of your question kind of indicates a lot of the reasons why people don't necessarily know the Lumbee story. They don't know many Native perspectives at all on the early decades of settlement and the origins of the United States in that settlement. Native Americans, if they exist as part of that story, as you indicated, they're kind of the friendly, welcoming, hospitable tribes of primitive people who were just ready to get out of the way so that Europeans could come and pursue their freedoms here. The Lumbee story really gives us a rich example, like that of other Native American nations, that you can't understand U.S. history without understanding the ongoing role that Native people have played in the development of our society. And in particular, when you look at themes like justice and self-determination, self-determination being one of, I think, our founding principles as a United States nation, that's a value that the Lumbee Nation shares. And justice as well being something that we continue to fight for as Americans, but also as Native Americans, are two themes that strongly resonate in Lumbee history and that are also strong ties to the United States. So I teach and I write with the premise that you can't understand one without understanding the other.
So let's get into some of that history. You start out your book telling us about a person named George Lowry, and this is part of the story of the lost colony of Roanoke. Let's pinpoint that encounter and how the histories that came out of that have not been true to what actually happened.
So sometimes if people know one of the origin stories of the United States, they'll think of Thanksgiving at Plymouth Rock, or they'll think of Jamestown and Pocahontas and John Smith, or they'll think of the Lost Colony, this first permanent English settlement in what became the United States that was right on the coast of later the state of North Carolina. And the Lumbees, for many decades, were thought to be the descendants of, again, so-called friendly Native American tribes who took in these desperate English settlers as their colony essentially fell apart. And that story is very kind of convenient when you're trying to explain the persistence of an indigenous people, a Native people like ours, who also don't conform to the stereotypes of American culture that depict American Indians as, you know, teepee living, horse riding, spear throwing, or bow and arrow shooting warriors on the plains. Of course, American Indian tribes are a lot more diverse than that. Our cultures are all different. Our histories are all different. And the Lumbees being such a large group, it was really impossible for folks who would have preferred to think of American Indians as savage others to explain our existence. So one of the things that our European American neighbors did was to connect our history to that of this disappeared European colony in the 1580s. And in fact, you know, our survival and our adaptation to European presence is a much richer and more complicated story than just the kind of vanishing of that of those few people into a world of American Indians. In fact, our adaptation is the result of long-standing relationships and conflicts with European neighbors that have gone back hundreds of years. And that's a much more sort of typical story that endures in all Native American nations. This process of dealing with colonialism and the good and the bad that it's brought is something that is not as attractive or seductive as this idea of European Americans kind of vanishing or you know, becoming part of a Native American community and therefore changing that community forever. The Lost Colony story tends to be, it's more simplistic and it's therefore, I think, more attractive.
Yet within the Lumbee Indian sort of diaspora, there is also great diversity, right? I mean, how does the tribe compare to other distinct tribes? What sets it apart?
Well, first, let me just address some of the things it has in common with other tribes. An American Indian nation is a community that has existed as a political entity with leadership, having its own rules about belonging, who belongs and who doesn't belong, since before the existence of the United States. So when you look at who is an American Indian tribe or what is a tribe, you're looking at that kind of definition. Is it a political community that's existed since before the formation of the United States? And the Lumbees fit that definition along with the tribes that your listeners are probably more familiar with. One of the things that sets Lumbees apart is that our ancestors held land differently. They held land privately as individuals, so that when the United States government removed other American Indian nations in the Southeast, they were not able to remove my ancestors, partly because their landholding relationships didn't enable the federal government to negotiate treaties with our tribal leaders. So that type of history, that the relationship to land that we possess is somewhat different than other tribes in the United States. Though, of course, there are now many, many American Indians who own land privately, tribes who live on their lands and care for their lands in ways that are different than what the federal government imagined for them.
So why then has it, if this is, you know, if there's such a distinctiveness, what has hampered the struggle for federal recognition? Why did Lumbee Indians have to struggle apparently longer and harder than other tribes?
Well, it's partly because of that distinctiveness. So one of the conditions for federal recognition or the criteria is that the ancestors of this community would have made agreements with a government, federal or state government. And that implies, of course, that federal recognition is that the tribe in question comply with a certain kind of stereotype or cookie cutter sort of notion of what makes a tribe. Because the Lumbees, our ancestors, had fairly different types of relationships to land, as well as different types of relationships to leaders, relationships that the federal government didn't always recognize as distinctly Indian. We don't really fit that stereotype or that cookie cutter. That's kind of a fatal flaw in federal recognition policy. I think many scholars who have studied that policy recognize that it suffers the same flaws as all policies. It can't be a one-size-fits-all solution because not all tribes are the same size. or, you know, nor are they the same shape, or they don't have the same histories or contours. So federal recognition is not an especially adaptable idea, though there are ways in which the Lumbees have had recognition from the federal government. Actually, since the 1880s, the federal government has said, you are Indians, but we are not going to afford you the nation-to-nation relationship that we afford to other federally recognized tribes. So when the ancestors of a tribe that is federally recognized, such as the Navajo or the Pueblo tribes or any number of others in the United States, when those ancestors signed a treaty with the federal government, that was a form of recognition that endures to this day in federal Indian law. Mm-hmm. When Lumbee ancestors didn't sign such a document, and so we don't have that automatic or that sort of we don't meet that particular criteria of what it means to be a tribe. I think the problem with federal recognition and why Lumbees have it's still incomplete for us is that the notions of what a political community is different for indigenous nations than it is for the United States. And the United States federal government has some work to do to reckon with all of the distinctive ways in which American Indians think of themselves as political communities, as nations with citizens.
Now, this is a tribe that is very prevalent throughout the eastern and southern United States. The South is, the history of the South is one that has kind of become fodder for political controversy these days. And we, of course, know that the South's history is very much intertwined with the history of slavery in the United States. Where did the Lumbee tribe, the Lumbee Indians, figure into that history, not just during slavery, but after slavery, after emancipation in the Jim Crow South? I know you've written a book about Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South.
Yeah. So slavery is part of the larger imperial project that European Americans have carried out here. Both, of course, chattel slavery began with American Indians. American Indians were the first enslaved people in the South before Africans began to arrive here. But when the African slave trade began to take over the economy, there was a reason economically and socially for European Americans to assert their supremacy over a group of people that they were trying to hold as property. And that desire to assert supremacy involved, in our case, in the case of this region, the South, the erasure of Native people at the same time. So having a kind of third community made it very, very difficult for European Americans who wanted to assert that supremacy to rationalize it. When you have one group attached to a racial identity that is enslaved and another group with a different racial identity that's free, it makes it really difficult to have a third group. Where do you put them? In which category, especially if it's a non-white group and a free non-white group at that, it's particularly difficult to then sustain the idea that all African Americans should be enslaved and all European Americans should be freed. So for a long time, Lumbees, especially before the Civil War, were thought of as free people of color. That identity as Indian, that label as of Indian, did not accompany us in the documentary record. And so while Lumbee families have always thought of themselves as Indian, as Native, there have not always been regarded that way by outsiders, by governments or others. And so the part of the reason for that is this desire to perpetuate slavery, and in particular race-based slavery, the idea that if you were black, you should be enslaved. They could not, of course, make that true in every single case, but part of the strategy behind erasing the identity of Native people in this region has been to support slavery. And then after the Civil War, after emancipation, white supremacy again became, there had to be a process to affirm it, to uphold it and design it. And so segregation became part of that process, commemorating the Confederate cause became part of that process. And there was another reason for Indians to either be erased, which is what happened in some region of the South. They were kind of legally eliminated, especially in states like Virginia. But here in North Carolina, American Indians took that time period and said, this is an opportunity for us to assert our autonomy. And so they took advantage of segregation in particular to separate themselves from whites and from blacks. And wow. In the case of Lumbees, forming their own schools and churches in order to sort of take segregation and turn it around into something that would support their self-determination.
That's fascinating. So let's talk about where this community is today. This is a distinct tribe, but it's for reasons we've discussed, is still waiting to get full federal recognition. Does that mean that there is no sort of home base in terms of land owned by the tribe or controlled by the tribe, as other tribes may have reservations or may have political relationships and specific treaties with the U.S. Are Lumbee Indians sort of disparately geographically scattered throughout the eastern United States?
Well, no, we're quite concentrated. I mean, we live all over the United States. I used to live in Berkeley for a while in Northern California. There's actually quite a community of Lumbees in California and elsewhere, Baltimore, Detroit, lots of other cities. You'll find Lumbees. But our homeland is in southeastern North Carolina in Robeson County, which right now is underwater, most of it, because of Hurricane Florence.
You and I are speaking at the time that Hurricane Florence is still pounding the area. Yeah.
Yes, and the river is rising today, and the flood may get worse. That is our homeland. So when people see those images or think about that hurricane, it's impacting us the most heavily. Our homeland has been sustained over time, not because it's reservation land, but because it's privately owned land. So our families, our ancestors, acquired deeds to their land, to their farms, back around the time of the American Revolution or even before. And over time, that land has largely been held by descendants of those, I call them founding families in the book. And those founding families acquired title to those lands. Their descendants still have title to those lands. And we have no intention of leaving or abandoning it or otherwise reducing our attachment to it.
What would federal recognition then grant the Lumbee Indians?
Well, it would provide an acknowledgement of our government-to-government relationship with the U.S. So, for example, that government-to-government relationship provides for particular kinds of economic relationships to land. So the federal government can take land into trust, and the tribal government can operate and own certain types of businesses on that land that it can't otherwise operate on other types of land that's controlled by the state government. So that type of economic opportunity is available to tribes because federal recognition is a form of a reparation. It's a way of saying the United States or the citizens of the United States seized land, stole property, injured American Indian nations, culturally, physically, and otherwise, and that this type of status is a kind of reparation for that activity. And the special abilities that tribes have to promote economic development are as a result of that federal recognition status. And it's because of the government-to-government relationship that tribes can have with the United States. It's acknowledged in the U.S. Constitution and has been perpetuated with federal Indian law ever since then.
What sort of political infrastructure or system continues to exist among Lumbee Indians? Is there are there chiefs? Is there a hierarchy of governance that continues today based on historical tradition?
One of the fascinating things about doing a history that's 300 years, covering 300 years of time, is that you get to see how political structures change over time. And the United States wrote its constitution in the 1780s, and the Lumbee tribe wrote its constitution in the 1990s. So it's been a really interesting journey for us to go from systems of government that the U.S. did not necessarily recognize but were nonetheless legitimate to a system of government that's constitutionally driven that the United States also recognizes. And so we have a tribal chairman, we have a tribal council, we have an executive branch that operates various activities and programs on behalf of the tribal government, including housing, cultural programs, economic relief, aid in the case of some of the things that are going on right now. And that constitutional government provides us with a form of representation that is similar to what we've been familiar with over these many hundreds of years, but it's also a little bit different. Lumbees have continued to hold on to their own churches, so not all Lumbees worship exclusively with other Lumbees, but we do have churches that are predominantly Lumbee that are governed by Lumbees, and because of how those churches have developed over time, that forms a kind of leadership and authority as well. So not simply the pastor or the leader of the church, but their other church leaders and community leaders are recognized by their affiliation with our various churches. We have probably 90 or 100, if not more, Lumbee churches in our community.
And then finally, are there efforts among Lumbee Indians, as there are among other Native American tribes, to preserve language, to preserve ritual, to promote, especially among young folks within the community, within the tribe, of the cultural hallmarks of the tribe's tradition?
Well, yes, that's an interesting question. I mean, the Lumbees have lost memory of our indigenous language, and it's probably multiple languages that our ancestors spoke. The particular situation that Europeans saw when they arrived here was hundreds, maybe dozens or maybe hundreds of American Indian villages and communities in this region that we live in now, and they spoke a variety of different languages. It was a very diverse, multilingual society. So our ancestors came to speak English because as they suffered through war, disease, and slavery in the early decades of European colonization, the survivors came to have one language in common, and that was English eventually. So fast forward a couple of hundred years, and we don't know all of the languages that our ancestors spoke. There are various attempts through research and study, but by tribal members and others of our relatives, to recover languages that our ancestors spoke, such as the Shiraw language or the Tuscarora language. That's a type of activity that I think some Lumbee people and Tuscarora people are very invested in. And then for others of us, we really look at the foundations of our identity, which are our families, our kinship systems, our relationships to place, our homelands, our cemeteries, the ways that we think about our stories as kind of sacred oral traditions. Those are things that are carried on and passed on from generation to generation. And sometimes there's a formal attempt or a formal way of talking about those aspects of our culture, but mostly it happens at home with our families. And we haven't really needed a government to keep that going.
Wow, such a fascinating history. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, Melinda. And of course, people can pick up a copy of your book to get the full detailed history, Lumbee Indians and American Struggle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
My guest has been Melinda Maynard Laurie. She is a Lumbee Indian herself, an associate professor of history and director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And her earlier book was called Lumbee Indians in the Jim Crow South. We've just been talking about her newest book that's called Lumbee Indians and American Struggle. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video podcast, our video channel that is on Vimeo.